The Columbia Workshop. This evening we bring you an original drama, The Autobiography of an Egotist, an amusing piece of imaginary introspectiveness and self-revelation. It is the work of John K. Lagerman, formerly a member of Columbia's publicity staff and now a freelance writer. This is the second piece of Mr. Lagerman's that has been presented by the workshop. We bring you now The Autobiography of an Egotist by John K. Lagerman. This is the autobiography of an egotist. The man whose life story you are about to hear from his own lips speaks to you from his apartment in a vast estate overlooking the Hudson River. He is, by his own wish, alone there now beside another microphone. The subject himself is, I'm sure, fairly well known to most of you, at least in name, for before he went into retirement a little over 10 years ago, he figured frequently in the national press. Since with each passing day, his mind becomes more and more deeply occupied with his own private studies, he has taken this occasion, during what his friends somewhat humorously refer to as one of his rare lucid intervals, to acquaint us with the history of his life. Ladies and gentlemen, the autobiography of an egotist.
Good evening. The subject tonight is one which interests me very much. It interests me, in fact, to the exclusion of everything else. That, I suppose, is why the voice before mine introduced me as an egotist. Personally, I should prefer the terms egocentrist or solipsist. For my egotism, being absolute, is not to be confused with the occasional spasms of self-conceit which pass for egotism in the popular acceptance of the term. Well, enough of definitions. My life will illustrate well enough the meaning of the term. Let us then begin at the beginning. Or better, let us begin before the beginning. For long before I was conceived in an earthly sense, I was I. The perfection of my being then can only be expressed by utter silence. It was flawless, absolute, unthinkable perfection. Even after the misfortune of conception, my being went on serenely enough, like the faint, monotonous throbbing of a shell held close to the ear. Then came a distinctly unpleasant occurrence. I was born. It was a terrible shock. My first utterance was in protest at this sudden degeneration into individuality. But though I kicked and cried and tossed, I slept most of the time and was able for long periods to recapture a semblance, at least, of the old perfection of my being.
Now, darling, give Mummy a teensy weensy smile.
The trouble really started with those voices.
Ah, that's my...
Does my baby want his...
It was that incessant, inane babble which cracked open my complete and unquestioning preoccupation with myself. I answered back. That was my first great mistake. It amounted to de facto acknowledgement of something existing independently of me. Hard as I tried to dismiss this revolting display of parental pride and affection as mere static in my oneness with cosmic perfection, I had at last to admit that it was produced by beings who were not me. I was furious.
No! Oh, now, honey, darling, don't cry. Good evening,
my darling. But my protest did more harm than good. They succeeded only in unleashing another barrage of interference. Lying back in my crib, I brooded over the problem. Gradually, the solution came to me. Instead of resenting attention, I invited it. I laughed and clapped my hands. I had, you see, robbed my parents of every vestige of self-identity by learning to use them. Use them as mere neuter instruments for the gratification of my whims and needs. It worked beautifully. They trundled me round and round the park in a satiny bed, mounted on wheels. They rocked and crooned me to sleep. They fed me, bathed me, tickled and soothed me. I felt safe once more. The world was mine alone. I was sublimely happy until I made a terrible discovery. I could talk.
Oh, John, did you hear that?
And before his second birthday.
Cool.
Why, the child's precocious.
Yes, I was a precocious child. I could talk sooner and more volubly than most. All through my third year and the early part of my fourth, I succeeded admirably in warding off or assimilating to my own purposes every influence which might have distracted me from my utterly blissful preoccupation with myself. So resourceful was I in cutting up and boiling down all manner of people and things into a kind of clam chowder of self-awareness that I might have lived my span on earth without once having been made aware that the very universe was not created for and inhabited by me alone. This, I say, might have been my happy fate, had it not been for an obnoxious fellow four-year-old called Bascom.
I want you to meet your little next-door neighbor, dear. His name is Bascom, and he's going to be your first little playmate.
Yes, might do the kids some good to see somebody his own age for a change. Say, what's the matter with you two? Can't you say hello?
Hello. Hi, sissy.
I disliked Bascom intensely from the first moment I laid eyes on him. As I remember him now, he was a fat and impudent little boy with two widely spaced front teeth protruding like small tusks under a surly upper lip. I hated the little fellow instinctively as a threat to the allness of my ego. Something had to be done about Bascom.
Now, Mummy and Daddy are going into the other room, and we want you to be good little playmates. I know you're going to be great friends.
There he stood, looking at me with those piercing little pig's eyes of his, refusing stubbornly to melt into my one-person universe. Somehow I had to dispose of him. Now, if I could just rouse his affections, then like my parents, Bascom might become merely another natural phenomenon at the service of my ego. I brought to bear on him all my infantine charm.
Oh, Sailor's popgun. Here I see it. So what? Well, it's broken, so you can have it. Nuts to you. I've got a pocket knife, too, and an automobile, and I've got an electric train. You can look at them.
Oh, fooey on that junk.
Huh? What are you gonna do?
I don't like you. I think I'll hit you.
Oh!
That chubby four-year-old right to my solipsistic chin was catastrophic. Its effect was cumulative through the years. It brought me my first acquaintance with the sensation of deliberately inflicted pain. But that was the least of its devastation. My ego-tight universe was split wide open, and into the wedge stepped this cocky little mortal from next door. With him came humiliation, uncertainty, and fear. I was no longer alone in the world. I could no longer call it my own, and all because of this lisping, snaggle-toothed little demon called Bascom. He didn't like me, he said. It had never occurred to me that I could be disliked. Most persons, I found later, make this painful discovery at a more mature age. But being precocious, I was not to be spared, even in infancy. I swiftly lost my charm, even for my parents, who took to scolding me.
Why, of all things, my very best bed cover used as a tent, and in this muddy backyard. Young man, you come here this instant.
And even to spank.
You've had this coming to you for a long time. Now, let this be a lesson to you.
No. Alas, my parents were no longer the doting idiots of my early days. They packed me off each morning to kindergarten.
Well, at last I'll have a few hours in peace today.
And later to progressive school, where things got progressively worse and worse. For there were, I discovered, dozens and dozens of little Bascoms to be dealt with everywhere. On the other hand, there were like numbers of little boys who felt as I did about the Bascoms. I made each of these boys another me, an alter ego, as I learned to say later. I identified myself with a number of them in a pugnacious society called the Elm Street Gang. It was my first experiment with society as a means of assuring my individual supremacy in the world. What each of the gang wanted, to come right down to it, was to live in a world in which he could recognize himself and everyone else. A world without competition or contradiction. In short, each of us wanted the world for his very own oyster. I think I must have sensed every now and then the implausibility of conflict as a means to this end, for I tried on various occasions to renounce it. My first attempt occurred at 17, for in that year, I fell in love.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself. You, a grown man, fighting like that.
Well,
if you come to school with another black eye, I'll never let you carry my books again. And I won't go with you to the senior prom either.
Oh, gee, don't talk like that, Miriam. You don't know how it makes me feel.
Her name was Miriam, and the sound of it was sweet in my mouth.
Miriam. Miriam. What rhymes with Miriam?
Are you ill, dear? You don't look well. You've been so quiet lately. And sitting there now with that pencil in your mouth.
Oh, I'm all right, Mother. Can't you see I'm just thinking? A person has to think once in a while, don't they? But gravy, why can't people let me alone?
All right, Sonny, all right. But mooning about that Reynolds girl isn't going to improve your school marks any. You ought to get out more with other boys. Get exercise. Now, at your age,
oh,
I would...
Oh, I'm not mooning about Miriam.
Oh, yes. Miriam.
Well, a person has no privacy around this house anymore. Gee whiz, Pop.
I never did find an exact rhyme for Miriam. The closest I came to it was delirium. But somehow the connection didn't occur to me then. I lost my appetite for food. In high school classrooms, I scarcely heard the droning voices of the teachers. At home, my parents seemed strange and unreal. I avoided my old playmates. Reality narrowed down to one person, Miriam Reynolds. I tried to convey this to her at the senior prom.
Hadn't we better be getting back now? People might begin to wonder why we're staying out here so long, all alone. You know.
People, people. Who cares what people think? We're the only ones who count now, Miriam. We're in love. So why should we care what people think?
Yes, I know. But this is dance number 7, and I promised it to Billy Oppenheimer. See, his name is right here in my card.
Oh, you beautiful, Miriam. Let me look into your eyes. I guess you're the most beautiful girl in the world.
Oh, dear, you don't really mean that. You're just saying that.
Of course I mean it. I'd never lie to you, Miriam. I couldn't. Of course, you've got a lot of freckles, but you'll outgrow those.
You're sure you'll never love anybody but me, darling?
Oh, Miriam, how can you ask such a thing? I couldn't ever.
Neither could I. Not ever.
Give me one more kiss, Miriam.
Well, all right. But only one, remember. Then I've got to go in and finish this dance with Billy Oppenheimer. Like I promised I... Oh. Boy, it must be terribly wrong to kiss like that.
Oh, you could never do anything wrong, Miriam. Hear what they're playing? Girl of my dreams. That's you. Miriam, you are the girl of my dreams.
Yes, that's exactly what she was. The girl of my dreams, the finished product of my adolescent imagination. For years, I had been drawing up the specifications. Whenever anyone detracted from my sense of security or self-importance or in any manner interfered with my wishes, I made a negative specification.
She won't be like that.
The positive specifications were suggested by the people who gave me everything I wanted, praised me to the skies, made me believe or gave me no reason not to believe that I was the smartest, handsomest, most important young man in the world. My ego got to work on this material. And finally modeled an impossible creature known to me for a time only by the name of my ideal. Then along came Miriam Reynolds. And my ego said,
"You're it, baby."
From that moment, I never saw the actual Miriam Reynolds. I saw in her only the creature of my imagination, my own beloved ego parading in petticoats. For a time, this device worked beautifully. And Miriam, alias myself, was the only person who really mattered in this world. It still pains me to confess that the Miriam I was never to know soon tired of playing the role of rose-tinted looking glass to my ego.
I am, too, going to the fair with Bascom. At least he takes me places and shows me some consideration.
But, Miriam, have you forgotten all you've said?
It was always you did most of the talking. Person gets tired of just listening to you talk, talk, talk all the time.
You go with Bascom, it'll be the end.
I don't care. I hope it is, so there.
It was. I was crushed, of course. But not for long. For soon another Miriam came along. Her name was Sally. Then another, Eleanor. Then others, many others. I can't recall their names. But they were all beautiful, all models of feminine perfection, all perfect goddesses, until they got tired of being goddesses and insisted on being themselves. Looking back, I would say that this unhappy insistence on individuality was the most serious fault I had to find with the distaff side. Albeit, I must confess, this fault was not theirs exclusively. Men and institutions had it, too. In college, I bumped into it constantly.
Come on, Steve! Oh, break that line, Steve! Oh, look! There's Dick Guard breaking through! He's done it! A touchdown!
Yeah, what of it?
I had failed, you see, to make the team myself.
Why all the hysteria?
Why all the... What's the matter with you? Doesn't anything thrill you?
Oh, I'm afraid my tastes are a little more intellectual. Now, if it were a debate...
Oh, he's going to make the kick. Oh, isn't he wonderful?
I just missed getting a place on the debating team.
And finally, ladies and gentlemen, our worthy opponents would have you believe that government ownership would destroy individual initiative. To them, I say, what about the post office?
Lousy, isn't he?
Oh, he's not so bad. I think he's pretty good.
Huh? Him? Well, one man's meat, I always say. Boy, you couldn't drag me up there on that platform.
Hey, pipe down. I want to hear this.
And welcome. I'm going down and have a drink. See you later. Boy, wait till I write up stuff like this for the campus echo.
But my style was far too advanced for a mere college weekly.
Say, did you see the editorial in the Campus Echo this week? A piece called War Goes to College. Say, can those boys down there write?
Think so? I never read the rag. Pretty infantile stuff, if you ask me.
Of course, I could always retreat into my dream world in which life still revolved about my ego. But even this became less and less tenable as the heavy artillery of fact tore gaping holes in my defenses. It kept me hopping, believe me, patching up the holes, meeting every disappointment with a new compensation. They came easiest in Pat's Bar and Roadhouse. I might have lost the battle if it hadn't been for...
As a bunk, I tell you. College education is a bunk. What can those little men with the big horn-rimmed spectacles know about life? Life. How you take me for... Hey, you want... Listen...
Yes, I became a heller, a campus renegade, a souse, a devil of a fellow. Drink softened the blows of reality. Drink made impregnable my retreat into the dream world where it was only I who really mattered.
So I says to him, hey, you can't do that to me, I says. He wanted to get me on the football team and on the debating team and on the weekly. I says to him, oh, no, you don't. Not this baby. He's got more important things to think about.
I had stumbled, you see, on a wonderfully simple recipe for making champagne out of sour grapes. And the beverage was very intoxicating. Under its influence, I was able to live in the world with the population of one. But this was too good to go on forever. One cold March night in 1917, just 3 months before graduation, I was driving a girl home through a sleet storm in a borrowed automobile.
Listen, please, please, slow down. It's slippery and you're drunk.
I'm drunk, huh? So you think I'm drunk, do you? I'll show you who's drunk. I'll show you who's driving this automobile. Nobody can tell me what to do.
I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but you're going 60 miles an hour.
Like so many drivers after me, I had discovered in the automobile a great boon to the ego. For in driving, I created a world of which I was master. The faster I drove, the more absolute became my seeming mastery. Seeming, I say, because...
Slow down, I tell you. There's a curve up ahead. Oh, God, look out!
Despite over 20 years of mechanical progress, automobile crashes then sounded very much as they do now. Their results, too, were about the same. Next morning, I woke up in a hospital ward with a dozen other patients The doctor passed my bed without appearing to notice me.
Oh, doctor.
What's that? Oh, you.
Tell me, am I going to be?
There's nothing the matter with you, not physically. You can get out. The sooner, I should think, and the further, the better.
And the girl?
She's dead. Though you killed her, the law, unfortunately, does not yet recognize this form of murder. Good day.
Yes, I was despised as a murderer. This was in March. In April, the United States entered the war. I was saved. Here was my chance to restore my sense of self-importance. The very same people who despised me for killing with a motor car accidentally would regard me as a hero if I used a gun deliberately to kill. I joined up. There were thousands of other volunteers marching with me down Fifth Avenue, but I was sure the crowds were cheering for me alone. I felt the same way as we marched through Paris to the Gare du Nord, for I had been able to regard myself as a hero from the moment I joined up. This was my own, my personal war. I would be a captain soon, then a major, soon a major general. Meantime, I was ready to die a thousand glorious deaths. A thousand glorious deaths. But not the kind of deaths I witness now on these blood-sodden fields. Ugly, efficient, anonymous. We were four in a dugout. Cold, hungry, exhausted. But I alone was shivering.
When you gonna win the war, Hero?
Yeah, how about it, Hero? Don't the Boche know you're here yet?
Hey, don't disturb him, fellas. Hero's thinking. Yeah. Hey, what's the matter, Hero? Miss your feather blanket?
When you going to win the war for us, Hero?
Yeah, how about it, Hero? Hey, don't the Boche know you're here yet?
Ah, don't disturb him, fellas. Hero's thinking he is. Figuring out how to win the war all by himself.
There it is, boys. Up to Daisy. Over we go.
So long, Hero. Don't get into mischief.
I hope they get you. I hope they get you all.
An hour after going over, I was lost. Completely lost. Clouds covered the sky. I had no idea of direction. I heard machine gun fire almost continually, sometimes close at hand, but I gave it a wide berth. It might have been the enemy. I crawled through the forest on my hands and knees till the dimming light told me it was near nightfall. I had one last desperate hour in which to find my way to our encampment. Kneeling in the underbrush, I took a look around, then cautiously rose to my feet, started out in an arbitrary direction.
Who's there? They got me. I'm done for. They got me.
It's only the leg. It's not bad. Here, Walter. Help me with him.
Yes.
There were six of them in this machine gun nest. One of them stripped off my leggings and bound up my wound as they worked on me.
Good. Now just lie quiet. That's it.
Another where we are. Cease firing. That is our last belt. You there. Hurry with that wound.
Yeah, it is done. He can walk now.
Listen to me, you American. Huh? Over there are your comrades. Soon they will throw grenades and we shall all be killed. You included. But we have a plan. Now, here is your gun. I have removed the bullets. You are to take us captives. You will shout to your comrades. Before they come, we will explode grenades here to make it look right.
I see.
Then you will lead us prisoners to your camp. You understand, American?
Yeah.
You will be a big hero. We will all remain alive. Hans, explode grenades.
Yeah. Here they go.
American hero, you have taken us prisoner. Call to your comrades for cease firing.
All right, but put down that gun. You don't have to point it at me.
Be quick, my friend. We have not much time.
Hey there! I got them! Come ahead now, don't fire! I got them!
Within 48 hours, I actually believed that I had captured six Germans single-handed. After all, why shouldn't I have believed it? Everybody told me I had done it. Back in Paris, a French general accorded me...
To the distinguished American soldier who, faced with insuperable odds, succeeded through sheer valor in capturing single-handed six of the enemy, I am now proud to award...
Once more, I was happy. Almost as happy as I had been as a baby when nobody in the world had any importance except as they served my needs. I was shipped back a few months before the armistice to tour the country and lectures on patriotism. At the peak of my popularity as a professional hero, I sold my goodwill assets to the highest bidder, a large manufacturing company which made me honorary vice president at a salary very near that
members
of the president
of
the United States.
As your chairman, I take great pride in introducing to you this afternoon a man whose selfless devotion to an exalted ideal has made him an inspiration to the whole of the civilized world. I feel sure that his name among
but
our
role this time,
vice
I wasn't even listening. My eyes had taken a faraway gleam. The speaker must have noticed him.
He sits among us now, but his mind is far away. In spirit, he is back in the trenches with his beloved buddies. He is thinking of that day.
A lot he knew about what I was thinking. At that moment, I was trying to figure out how I could take his job away from him. For I had discovered something. Something far more effective than mere glory in expanding my ego. I had discovered money, and the promise of its power intoxicated me. With money, my ego need know no bounds. With money, I could buy the world. With money, I could buy men's wills. With money, I could live not just one life, but 10 lives, 10,000 lives. Money that was mine became me. I thought of nothing else, dreamed of nothing else, lived for nothing else. And during the next 10 years, I made money. More and more money. I made money, plenty money, in rails. Money in motors. Money in steel. Money in textiles. Money in wheat. Money in corn. Money in men. Money in land. Money in the land and the men of America. Money and power for me. Me! 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 Oh, pardon me. For a moment there, I was almost carried away. For just a moment, I was back in 29 before they took me away. Before I came to this quiet retreat on the Hudson. My doctors have just come in. They're looking at their watches and shaking their heads. Yes, gentlemen, I'm quite all right. No cause for alarm. Now to conclude my autobiography. I was brought here, as I say, 10 years ago. I've been happy enough, I suppose. The announcer very kindly referred to this as my estate. Well, that's a pleasant little conceit of mine, which I shall believe once more in a little while. He spoke, too, of this room overlooking the Hudson. Actually, the room has no windows, but it is pleasant enough. The walls finished in a soft material which gives under pressure. I must say I find this very convenient at times. I have suffered only minor bruises. In a way, this this estate has given me what I've always desired. It has given me back the world of my childhood, a world populated solely by me. I should be very happy here. But I'm not. Do you know why I'm not happy here? Well, I'll tell you. I'm lonely. I'm lonely. Lonely! Lonely!
The Columbia Workshop has just presented The Autobiography of an Egotist, an original drama for radio by John K. Lagerman. The performance was under the direction of Earl McGill. The part of the egotist was played by House Jameson. Next week, the workshop will bring a special leap year program of unusual interest. It will feature many Columbia personalities familiar to the American radio audience, but they will appear in roles and characters not normally associated with their professional duties. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.